Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing founder, you know, a founder that not only has done it once, he has done it twice when it comes to building a billion-dollar company. As they say, once you're lucky, twice you're good. So I think that we're going to be learning quite a bit on the show today. We're going to be learning about, you know, how he went about, you know, just starting a company, being an immigrant in the U.S. Actually, that company ended up going public. Then also being an outsider and then becoming an insider, as well as, you know, the process of building a unicorn, as well as shifting from one segment to another, just like he did real estate. Then he went into healthcare. So quite the changes. So again, building, scaling, financing, exiting, all of the good stuff that we like to hear. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Sami Inkinen. Welcome to the show.
Well, Alejandro, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, excited to be here.
So originally born and raised in Finland on a farm. Give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
It was pretty wonderful now looking back there. But yeah, I grew up on a farm in Finland, not far from the Russian border. My parents did not even go to high school. So it was, you could call, pretty humble beginnings. We had a bunch of chickens and a couple of pigs, and maybe half the food we ate, we grew on a farm. So I certainly learned the value and actually the joy of hard work and manual labor pretty early. It wasn't really by choice always because I had to work hard. But yeah, it was a beautiful time to and way to grow up as a kid.
So you got into physics, you know, there in Finland, and then eventually, you know, things took a different shift, and you got into software and computers. So tell us what really sparked the interest for software and computers for you.
Yeah, I guess going from potatoes and chickens to computers, it's a little bit of a quantum leap. But yeah, what happened to me is I got excited about computers through the pages of magazines. I'm talking like late or actually mid 80s. And so I convinced my father to spend a couple of $100 on a Commodore 64. So I think that opened my eyes already before I even turned 10 years of age, did the joys of computers. And then just to fast forward a little bit, I read about modems, US robotics, and BBSs, pre-internet bulletin board systems. And so I actually ended up starting and building and running one of the first, not the first, but one of the first BBSs in Finland from my, you know, bedroom, from my parents' house, and using our phone line for people to dial in into. So that's kind of all those experiences opened my eyes to, like, wow, there's much more to life than, you know, chickens and farm and potatoes. And I just got very excited about computers. And that's more or less, it's been the hammer or the tool in my back pocket ever since I was 10 years of old and of age. And it's really been the tool that I've used professionally ever since.
Well, one thing that was very helpful, you know, talking about learning, you know, was joining what was the equivalent to E-Trade there in Finland, you know, basically a stockbroker. You had the opportunity here of not only seeing something being built from scratch, but then also taken public. What do you think, you know, you gain access to in terms of visibility on the full cycle of a business like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And indeed, I was in the middle of doing my master's in physics and as a software developer and IT support person, I kind of financed my way through college. And then these couple of folks were starting a company called EQ Online, which you could call it the E-Trade of Finland. And I was probably the number one or two or three. Anyways, one of the first five employees that they hired. And literally this company went from zero to IPO in Finland, which is all the more remarkable because it's not like at the time it wasn't really known for building high-tech companies. From zero to IPO in, I think, less than 18 months. Yeah, it's, I think, a lot of things. So one was just, I guess, the emotional excitement of a team coming together and literally building something out of a scratch that within a year is used by, you know, a large portion of the entire country, whether that was 100,000 or a million users, I don't even remember how many. But to be able to create something from scratch as part of a team that people use and like to use, I don't know, it was just a very special experience. That alone was amazing. And then the second thing is, I'm just a huge believer in the extreme power of example and inspiration. And to be able to see that these wonderful and smart human beings and professionals, who at the end of the day were just no different from me, were able to make all that happen was very inspiring. It wasn't like I was thinking at the time, like, oh, I want to replicate this or that processes, but it clearly planted a seed in my mind at the time. So that was 1998 and 1999.
Now, you actually went at it on your own. You know, eventually, you know, you worked with companies like Nokia, but then eventually you started your own business, which was the first attempt, you know, called Matchem. And as you say, you know, you guys ended up getting that company acquired, but it perhaps didn't go as far as, let's say, like a Virta or let's say like a Trulia. How was that experience, you know, that first rodeo?
Yeah, I call it my million euro MBA. And the reason is we raised €1 million of funding, Series A, and blew all the money, and all we had to show was not much. So I call it my million euro MBA. But yeah, it was an amazing 3-year journey. A software company, my first, I would call real company that I co-founded in Finland. I lived a year in Singapore, year almost 2 years in Hong Kong as part of that, trying to build the business there, and we ended up selling it to a German acquirer at the end of that. But I would say it literally was like an MBA. You know, I was an engineer by training, into computers, and physicist formally training, and then suddenly I'm literally living in Hong Kong and trying to make the business and business development work, having never even traveled in a country before. So yeah, probably learned more through mistakes in 3 years that you would learn in a regular job in a decade. And at that point, I knew absolutely certainly that, you know, there's no way I should be building a career in a large, stable company in my life. The experience of coming together with the team, building something, the excitement of not knowing what's around the corner was just so captivating that I was like, oh, if I can replicate this in bigger circles, kind of like in the big leagues, it would be the most amazing thing I could do in my life, at least at that point.
So eventually you went to McKinsey, you know, which was the segue into your MBA, real MBA, you know, we stand for at least, you know, when it comes to degree MBA. And one of the things that is very interesting that hits me here is, one, what did you get from working at a place like McKinsey when it comes to breaking bigger problems into smaller problems, now to really be able to have a strategic direction when it comes to bringing a solution to market. But then also going from a farm, you know, where you were more like seeing potatoes, to then all of a sudden, you know, living in places like Singapore or even now the US, I'm sure that your worldview and the lens in which you approach problem solving too shifted quite a bit.
Yeah. And then, well, first of all, your listeners may be like, wait a second, you started a company, you sold it, whether it was a huge success or not, and then you joined McKinsey. Are you freaking crazy? Like, that doesn't make any sense. And in some ways, it probably doesn't make any sense. But the reason I wanted to join and was lucky enough to be able to join McKinsey was, in addition to this MBA path, it was actually my way of hopefully and potentially getting into America legally in Silicon Valley. So that was kind of in my mind at the time, like, oh, if I get into McKinsey, it's this global, amazing management consulting firm, I'm sure I can somehow wiggle through one office to another and end up in America legally. So that was kind of the motivating force. However, I learned a ton. And I'd say one of the main sort of problem solving and approaching a business that changed was when I went from doing my physics degree to starting a company, I went from all analysis and math to literally just shooting from the hip all the time. First time founder, like everything's, I felt like I always had 1,000 things to do, but I only had time for 5, no time to think. It was just literally shooting from the hip, like just running 100% of time, no deep thinking, no analysis. So I was on one end of the spectrum. And then I go to McKinsey after that experience for 3 years, and it's the opposite. It's like, zero execution, and 100% analysis, like just analysis. And the end product is basically a bunch of slides to a large client. So it was actually a very useful calibration that I went both of the bookends. The coming out of that McKinsey experience, it was like, okay, well, whatever you end up doing, the truth's usually somewhere there in the middle. So I think that helped me to calibrate, like, even if you're building something from scratch, you have to be running kind of 100 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour all the time. You do have to find the time to analyze and think so you aren't running to the wrong direction. So I say that was one of the bigger things I picked up at McKinsey, the ability to then have these different tools and modes of operating and building a company.
So talking about building a company, you know, you ended up going to Stanford, and that was kind of like the reset button, because that allowed you to maybe a slap across the face and, hey, you know, I got to go back to building companies now. So at this point is where, you know, a massive success story, you know, was born, and that was Trulia. So, and for the listeners, you know, we also did an episode with your co-founder there, with Peter Flint. Recommend listening to that one too. But tell us your side of the story. You know, how did the company come together? How did the band come together, you know, while you were there at Stanford?
Yeah, and I got very lucky, obviously, that I met Pete Flint, my co-founder, and it was an amazing journey together. But yeah, it might be surprising and interesting for your listeners to hear that, you know, I'm a physicist by training. I came from Europe. I come from outside of U.S., and no experience in residential real estate industry in the US. Well, guess what? My co-founder, Pete, also a physicist by training, also comes from Europe, also no real estate experience, and he's my Stanford classmate. So it's basically two completely unqualified immigrants who meet up and decide to start this company to take on one of the largest industries in the US, which is the residential real estate in the US. But how did it come together? Well, obviously, we were classmates, and we both knew that and respected each other and knew that we are entrepreneurially minded. We want to start something. So we were kind of both at the right time at the right place. So there was that element. And I think we were less, it wasn't like, oh, we both want to start a real estate company or online real estate marketplace. I think we both came into it through slightly different reasons and slightly different personal experiences. But at the end of the day, we both realized that the way Surge and these vertical specific companies like Expedia for airline tickets, Match.com for finding a spouse, and Hotels.com for finding a hotel, and so forth. What had happened in these different verticals, what you might call classified verticals online, in that there was a consumer first internet marketplace or internet service, would happen in residential real estate, but it had not yet happened 2003, 2004. So it was very clear to us that somebody is going to own the mindshare of consumers who want to buy a home or sell a home or rent a home. And that could be us. And so I think that's where we both landed. And then we had this inspiration and energy, and both as immigrants basically just wanted to build something in Silicon Valley. And I'm here in San Francisco in Silicon Valley right now. So that is the place to really try and spread your wings if you're an entrepreneur, and off we went.
So at what point do you realize with Trulia that you were riding a rocket ship?
That is, I love that question. I'll answer this in two different ways. One is that when you're inside a company you're building, there's no such thing as you've made it or success. In fact, once you start thinking, it's kind of like things will go sideways. So inside, this, to some extent, the answer is never. You always feel like you're in the middle of a card house and you're just trying to kind of like keep it together. So you're in your own fishbowl. So it never just feels like done and safe and stable and whatnot. So I think that's one part of it. But then the other way to answer the question, obviously, there's some objective measures. Obviously, when a company goes public, pretty objectively, you have a substantial business and it's worth your public market investors. So certainly at that point. But I think maybe end of 2009. And I say this because we had survived the drought of 2008, Lehman Brothers collapsed, and the industry that really got hit the worst was mortgage and residential real estate. And we are in the middle of that. And our clients are going out of business. We knew we can't raise more money. Our revenues are basically going down. It's like, if we don't die now, we are probably going to survive anything. So I would say, Yeah, that moment of maybe a year after the 2008 crash, when we turned a corner and knew that we are onto something, that probably was the first moment when I was like, whoa, this thing truly is here to stay, truly here to stay.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And the company ended up getting acquired for $2.5 billion by Zillow. So make us an insider. How was that process like? And also, what was the moment like when all of a sudden you inked the deal? You know, a company that you founded from nothing, you know, it's acquired for $2.5 billion, you know, a company that was co-founded too by an immigrant, you know, an immigrant that was born in a farm of potatoes. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, well, a couple of things there. Well, first of all, we went public 2012 and our peer company and competitor Zillow had gone public a little bit ahead of us. So we were two public companies at the time when we got the final offer for the merger. So it was two public companies basically coming together. Obviously, they were a little bigger than us and they acquired us. But leading up to that, we had had, which is public information, we had had multiple conversations about potentially teaming up because the MBA term industrial logic made sense that why are we trying to do the same thing in many ways, and we could have two brands and this would be more beneficial for our customers and efficiencies, all kinds of stuff. So we had had a couple of conversations. But quite frankly, particularly when we had these conversations as private companies, it's very hard to agree on valuations and this and that. Once companies are public, it's way more objective. All the information is out there. Share price kind of tells, or the market cap, what the company is worth. So it's actually much easier for public companies to do that, which probably made it much more likely. But I'll just finish off saying the very moment is kind of crazier than crazy. I had left my operational role 2014, and I was on the board of the company, and obviously a co-founder, but I wasn't running operationally. But what I was doing at the time was my wife and I were rowing in a rowboat across the Pacific Ocean, unsupported. It was kind of trying to, you know, raise awareness about the dangers of bad food and sugar. So we are literally on a halfway point between the Pacific Ocean or between California and Hawaii, halfway point, like more than 1,000 miles of just water both ways. And we have a satellite phone. And I get a text message to the satellite phone. Like, Zillow wants to acquire us for whatever, $2 billion, $3 billion. Will you accept this transaction? Like, this sounds like a movie scene, but this is actually true. Like, that was the moment. And I look at my wife while sweating and in pain and, you know, trying to keep rowing the boat forward. Can you believe this? What do I answer? And it was actually, in many ways, very confusing and emotional moment because it's kind of your baby. Obviously, we built together with the team and everything, but in the middle of the ocean. It's kind of your thing for a decade. And yeah, that's kind of how it happened. And obviously the answer was yes. And in many ways, it felt like a chapter in my book or in my life was absolutely, truly coming to an end. So it may sound like it's only sweet, but it definitely was bittersweet. It was very mixed emotion.
I hear you. I mean, always when you go through a transaction like that and it's a company that you've co-founded, it tends to feel like a loss in the family, you know, kind of thing. You know, it's a roller coaster of emotions. So I can totally understand that. Now, in your case, you know, one chapter closes, another one opens, and the next one is another billion-dollar company that you've created, which is called Verta. So for the people that are listening, you know, to get it, what are you guys up to at Verta? What is the business model? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, well, first of all, on a high level, we are solving the biggest metabolic health or health crisis in the world, that is type 2 diabetes and obesity, and you know, mission to reverse diabetes in 100 million people. And we achieve that as a telemedicine company, but the therapy is through nutrition and behavior. So we are a healthcare tech company. In terms of how we make money, well, it turns out reversing or curing diabetes is very valuable. And so we go and sell to healthcare payers, employers, health plans, and government, and say, hey, we can clean up the diabetes mess. We're going to help you save money. We work with companies like Papa John's or U-Haul or United Airlines and Blue Shield of California and the Veterans Administration. So they pay for our service to help people reverse diabetes and lose weight. And then the service for the actual patients is completely free. So that's the model. And so we get paid a couple of $100 per patient or user per month. And that's how it works.
And how much capital have you guys raised to date?
We have raised 10 times more equity capital than we raised for Trulia from zero to IPO. So Trulia, we raised about $33 million of equity, zero to IPO. And for Verta, we raised about $360 million.
I mean, I'm sure that it was a little bit easier to raise money this time around, no, with your background. So how did you go about raising money? You know, like what did you look for in the people that you were bringing on from one cycle to the next? And how do you think the expectations shifted, you know, as you were going from one cycle to the other?
Yeah, well, first, I should say, I personally don't glorify fundraising or the money raised or amount raised. And the way I describe it internally for my team, I'm like, it's like a mortgage, but these days you get mortgage for 7 or 8%. Guess what? This equity from VCs, we want to pay back at 50% or 100% year over year. So this is very expensive money. We can't take it lightly. We have to take it super duper seriously. So, and the amount of money raised to me is not a measure of success. It's literally is a $360 million mortgage that we have to and we want to pay back. But in terms of fundraising, obviously there's a balance of some people say raise as much as you can, and some people raise as little as you can. To me, the truth somewhere there in the middle. For our type of a business with long B2B sales cycles, we did a clinical trial. You just need a certain amount of capital. You absolutely need a certain amount of capital. And then, of course, you need some buffer, like if something doesn't go to plan. So that's kind of how I think about the amount. But and then you do need to time the market as well. Like when money isn't available, it's hard to raise. When it's available, you want to be racing, even if you aren't feeling like you need it right now. So I guess it's a balance of being opportunistic, which we were in 2021 when we raised money at the peak. It wasn't like, oh, we desperately need money, but I had seen the dance before. In fact, Trulia, we raised money very early 2008, and then Lehman Brothers collapsed and there was no money available at all. And so had we not done that March, April 2008 fundraise, we would have gone out of business. And I remember thinking the same thing 2021. I was like, we don't really need capital, but I've seen this dance before. It may come in handy. Well, we know what happened 2022, so it has come in handy. So trying to be pragmatic, but then also opportunistic.
So obviously, you know, like when it comes to investors, you know, and what you were saying, the $360 million mortgage, you know, it comes with a vision. You know, they're really betting on a vision. So if you were to go to sleep tonight, Sammy, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Verta is fully realized, what does that world look like?
It probably looks like Europe in 1970s. That is, that we don't see a lot of obese people with type 2 diabetes. like, quite frankly, this may sound very idealistic, but I was so done building companies and for-profit companies after Trulia. It was an amazing journey, but I was pretty exhausted. I was like, okay, I've done that. No need to do that again. However, I did come out of like quasi-retirement to start Verta Health, but I did not start Verta in any way to like, oh, I want to start another company or build another company, or that was not the point. The point was I accidentally stumbled on a way to basically help hopefully billions of people reverse type 2 diabetes and lose weight. And this whole metabolic health mess is that's bankrupting U.S. healthcare. It is solvable. It can be solved. And then I just chose a for-profit company as the best tool to do that, because you can raise capital, you can attract talent, you can do everything. So, but the fact that we are a company, the fact that we are a for-profit company and hopefully very successful, it literally is just a tool. It's a means to an end. It's like a car for a road trip. The point is not the car. The point is the road trip and enjoying that. So that's kind of like the vision that I have, is that hopefully we'll fix the problem, or at least a big part of that problem. And guess what? If we do that, we are going to make a shitload of money for our investors and employees and everyone. And so it's hopefully that's how it ends up working out.
So obviously this is the second company that you do, but the second one that is a $1 billion business. What's the formula? You know, Sammy, you know, obviously this is the second time around, you know, you can compare with the first time around that it was not in the billion mark, but this is the second time. So what's the formula? What can you share with the people listening?
Yeah, I guess like you said, once you're lucky, twice you are even luckier. That's how I like to think about. Well, honestly, I do not think there's a formula. Like there is no formula, and that is part of the formula. It's a circular reference there, but there is no formula is part of the formula. But I do think there's a couple of things that are sort of universal. I'll just throw you a few here. Number one, if you never start or take the first step, nothing's going to happen. And it just sounds very simple, but there's so many people like, I want to start a company and do this. And they just talk. They just never take the first step. The first step is actually way more important than people realize. And it's kind of like drawing across the Pacific. People, how are you able to do that? I'm like, once you take the first oar stroke, like you actually have no choice. You just have to take a million of them. And then you end up in Hawaii from California. So that's one thing. Second one is, I've always started from a problem. Like, hey, here's a meaningful thing to solve. And then you introduce the way in which you do and the technology. And I think way too many people are like, oh, now we've got this AI thing. Like, how do we apply this AI? I just think that's completely backwards. The world needs and values solutions to problems. But being very clear about like what is it that you're trying to solve, I think starting from there is very, very important. And then the third universal thing I would say, to build a growth company to a sustainable business, it is like the odds are like winning an Olympic gold. Which is to say, it's very hard. It's very, very hard. And so to achieve that, there's sort of two things that are, to me, very universal. You want to be A+ in everything, your investors, your employees, everything. Like if you want to win Olympic gold, like you better have the best coach, best nutritionist, best training plan, best genes, best everything. Like you just want to stack up everything for your benefit. And then the other one is, it's always the long game. If you just stay in business for a decade, you're very likely to do something very meaningful. And like I am, August 2024, it's 10 years that I've been working on Verta and with outside investors and others, 9 years. But so it's 10 years. So that's, and particularly first-time founders, they may read headlines. It's like, oh, $1 billion company. And, you know, they want to like, I don't know, put the money into crypto in the right time. No. All overnight success stories, or almost all of them, are 10 years in the making.
So let me ask you this, just to expand on this. Let's say I put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time. You know, let's say it's year 2000. You know, you're literally giving your notice to leave Nokia. And you're now, for the first time, becoming an entrepreneur, venturing into the unknown. Let's say as you're coming out of the, you know, big building of Nokia, you know, and wondering what the future holds, let's say you're able to stop that younger self on the tracks and you're able to give that younger Sammy one piece of advice before launching a business, just one, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
Honestly, I've had a lot of fun throughout the journey and at least the last two companies, well, Vertum is still private, but they've been objectively very impactful and successful. So I don't know, I probably anything I would say, I would mess up my naivety and everything. But yeah, so two things actually, because I have learned this sort of a hard way. Pace yourself, meaning to really take care of yourself, because it's always like this on like a decade plus journey to build something. So you have to, it's like running a marathon. Yeah, you may make a sprint over hill, but you cannot be sprinting all the time. Otherwise, you aren't going to finish the marathon. So pace yourself is one. And then the other one is you cannot finish work by working. And this isn't just like pulling all-nighters or something like that, but you can't finish work by working. Therefore, be very thoughtful about like what really matters and how you allocate your time. And I did not realize this during the Trulia years. So I constantly had this feeling, which is not positive, that, oh, there's 80 things I need to do, but I only have time for two now or something like that. Well, of course, that's a fact. But there's usually only a couple of things when you look back at the end of each year as a founder, like what are the one or two or three things that truly move the needle? And so the sooner you realize that and the more time you spend on like really understanding that I can uniquely affect this thing and that will have disproportionate impact on the outcome, the more you can actually have impact in that area and less stressful it is and all that stuff. And I think that's been much easier for me at Vertum. It doesn't mean that it's easier or less work or whatnot, but you can really kind of, it's kind of like starting a fire with the magnifying glass. Like you aren't going to start any fire unless you really focus the sunbeams or the photons into this one little piece. And that's how you start a fire. And I think that's needed in building a company as a founder.
I love it. So Sammy, for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
I actually surprisingly read my LinkedIn messages pretty well, or you can DM on Twitter as well. So yeah, online, I'm pretty responsive.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, hey, Sammy, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.